Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Children, children, can you hear that sound?
Isn't that my tinnitus?
Come closer and listen to a tale about a man with a belly like jelly.
With suspected metabolic syndrome.
Wearing a red coat, fur collar and cuffs.
Which is really a high-grade compression suit designed to withstand high G-forces.
Carrying a lofty sack.
Scrotal carcinoma.
With a joyful, gruff laugh.
Pulmonary edema due to acute altitude sickness.
This man, being a shill of Coca-Cola for many years, is of course Saint Nick, affectionately known as Santa Claus. Welcome everybody to the Christmas episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's Medical Podcast. Today we are doing something slightly different. We're still talking about the human body and physiology, but today we're talking about the human body of somebody very specific, somebody close to our heart, Matt.
Saint Nick.
Saint Nick. Santa Claus. We all love Santy. And as we're approaching Christmas, I think it's really important for us to talk about Santa Claus.
His physiology.
His physiology.
How he stays alive.
Well, yeah. I think once you...
Is this his favourite time of the year or his dreaded time, do you think, based on what we're going to talk about?
I think we should talk about it. And then in our final discussion and conclusion, we can determine whether we think Santa Claus is enjoying
this or not,
this Christmas period or not. So, Matthew, do you want to give us a quick run through as to the timeline of Santa Claus on Christmas Day and what his tasks are? And then we can sort of dissect it and have a look at what's actually happening to his sleigh, to his body, and how he's actually trying to withstand and resist some of these excessive forces on his physiology.
All right, so I think he lives in North Pole, so that's where he resides 364 days of the year.
Yeah.
I can't really tell you much more.
All right, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. There's the podcast.
In terms of his dwelling or what he does during the rest of the year.
Yeah, he's making presents, man. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
The elves specifically. So I think he's actually resting because he needs the rest after that. This one Christmas day.
Yeah, good point. So what he needs to do, his task for Christmas Day or Christmas Eve really, right?
Yeah, from Christmas Eve to Christmas morning, I suppose.
Well, he needs to deliver presents to children. Now, what's your cutoff age here? I've put it as 14.
Yeah, 14 years. Let's say 14 years. Yeah. We need, ladies and gentlemen, I should say dear listener, we need some cutoff periods. We're doing a lot of number crunching in this episode, as you'll soon find out. And so we need some hard cutoffs. So obviously there might be some 14-year-olds out there that don't believe in Santa Claus, God forbid, have no idea why. But we're going to use 14 as our cutoff date for the children that Santa Claus delivers presents to.
Okay, so based on that age, I think we just popped over 8 billion people worldwide recently, right?
Wow.
That was just a recent milestone. But if we're looking at age, in age brackets, for under the 14 years of age, there's about 2 billion children worldwide. Now, when we calculate, if we try to stratify those children into who's likely to celebrate Christmas, so these would be Christian more so, about 31% of the world are Christians. So that then brings the number down to approximately 620 million kids.
So he needs to deliver presents Christmas Eve to 620 million children.
Children, that's right.
Right.
Now.
But they all don't have separate homes, right? There's not one child per home.
Correct. So there's approximately 3.5 kids per household on average. Right.
Who's got the half kids?
Good point. Good,
and which half?
Yeah, that's right.
Doesn't matter. So 3.5 children per home.
Per household.
So yeah. How many households so that does he then need to leads, visit?
Yeah, that leaves him. He needs to visit 177,142,857 households.
Okay. Well, let's just round that up to 177 million homes.
Happy with that.
That he needs to visit. And so if we take into consideration all the time zones, right?
Can I just butt in here quickly?
Mm.
We do know that he only comes to well-behaved children. So what happens to the naughty kids?
They get coal usually, don't they?
Do we bring the number? Oh, sorry, he still has to deliver something to them.
Yeah, he has to deliver something. So
it's either presents or coal.
Now,
one thing I did just think of,
yeah,
and you might be able to answer this because you're from a Serbian background. Now, Serbians are Orthodox Christians.
Correct.
Is that a different Christmas day?
Christmas is in January for us.
Okay.
Yes. So you could you could theoretically say that a certain percentage of the population that he needs to visit occurs on a different day.
Yeah.
But look, for simplicity's sake, Christmas Eve, 24th of December, this is when he's delivering these presents, right? All right.
So what time does he have to deliver it?
Well, look, if we take all the time zones into consideration and he plans this out well, he's probably got around about a 36-hour time window to be able to deliver all these presents to 177 million homes. Now, if we do the maths here, which is 177 million.
Divided by 36.
Yes.
And it gives you how many per hour?
Yes. So he basically, he has to visit 1,365 houses per second.
Okay.
Right. So he's-
Busy man.
Yeah. So basically he has 1/1,000th of a second per house.
Per house.
Okay. To deliver. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is obviously within something that Santa Claus can do. He's got the power to do this. Yep. He's just traveling extremely quickly.
He's been
quickly
preparing this for the whole year.
Oh, yeah. He's moving quick. He's moving quick. But let's just say now he has arrived at his first house and
what is he going to do?
Yeah, what's he going to do?
Well, this is what I've calculated. He parks on the roof.
Right.
Okay. Hops off his sled, descends the chimney, finds somewhere in the household where the stockings are, or under the Christmas tree,
yeah.
Then goes back up to the chimney, back on the sled, off he goes to the next house.
So what distance do you think is covering just in a particular house?
20 metres. I calculated it.
Okay, so you're saying that obviously in the sleigh he's travelling further distances, but by foot Santa Claus is travelling 20 metres per house.
Yes.
And is visiting 177 million houses.
Yep.
Right. So that's a hell of a distance.
Him personally, in terms of exercising, is about 27 k's a second. What do you want to keep it per hour? Should we move it up to hours? What is he doing per hour?
Well, I mean, if he's covering 20 metres per house and is visiting 177 million houses, he's basically covering on foot 3.5 million kilometres.
For the whole night.
The whole night.
Yeah.
So he's not just running a marathon here.
A lot of them.
He's running many marathons.
But let's just pull it back to per hour because I think that's easier to calculate expenditure, energy expenditure and so forth because, you know, when we do certain things, we usually look at per hour. How about that? Yeah? So what I calculated is he's doing just under 100,000 kilometres per hour in terms of energy. Well, not energy expenditure, but how much he's jogging. Okay? So then what we can do is work out how much how much calories would a person burn per kilometre of just jogging? Are you happy with that? I kind of found the calculation around 70 calories per hour.
Yep.
Per kilometre, should I say. What do you think?
So basically a person, when running comfortably, not at high speed, which he is, but when running comfortably, they're burning, 60 to 70 calories per kilometre. So if he's traveling 177 million kilometres, if he's traveling 3.5 million kilometres,
yep,
times 60, 70 calories, how many calories is he burning in a night?
250 million calories a night.
All right. So he needs – that's a lot of calories. Yeah. I mean, I think I probably burn a couple of thousand calories a day.
Yeah.
He's doing this in a 36-hour time window. I need to eat a fair bit of food to replenish that. So to replenish, what, 200-odd million calories, what's he eating?
Do you think he's just been carbo-loading or do you think he needs nutrition along the way?
I think he needs something to top him up on the way. But I think we also know that when he's down that chimney, once he moves through and he's navigating his way to the Christmas tree or the stockings, usually we leave him a glass of milk and some cookies, right? Yeah.
Do you know where that tradition came from?
No.
It really just dates not that long ago to the Great Depression in America where Christmas, at least for giving gifts, it was seen historically more as giving rather than receiving.
Right. So
historically, at least what I came across, I found that stockings were pre-filled and they were actually presents for Santa.
Oh.
So he would bring presents but we would also give presents to him. And in the Great Depression, about the 1930s in America, things were quite dire. And so some of the things...
Yeah, I can tell by the name.
Some of the things that were left out were just like a bit of milk and a couple of probably stale cookies.
Wow.
So like you said, that's become the tradition.
Yeah.
And so usually what's left out for Santa is a couple of cookies and some milk. Do you want me to...
Okay, so let's just say... We need to think about this. So
we're trying to work out how does he overcome this 250 million calorie deficit for the night.
Yeah, so he obviously needs to get calories in.
Yeah.
And I would say the easiest way is to, you know, not spend the money himself. He doesn't have the time, first of all.
He can't visit 7-11.
But also the money to buy that many calories. Luckily, people are leaving out milk and cookies. So I would say, let's just say that per household – he drinks half a glass of milk.
It never finishes them.
Never finishes them.
It's always half done.
So he drinks half a glass of milk and maybe has one cookie.
Yep.
Per household. So let's start with the milk, right? Okay. So that's half a glass of full cream milk. Do you reckon he needs the full cream?
I've done full cream just to make it simple.
Okay, so he has half a glass of full cream milk
let's hope per it's household. Not lactose intolerant.
For 177 million houses. Yeah, imagine that. Maybe that's part of the jet engine that's on the sleigh. All right, so how much milk is he ingesting here, Matt?
About 88 million glasses of milk. And I've just calculated the glasses to be 240 mils, which is essentially a standard cup.
So how many litres does that end up being?
22 million litres of milk. So then when I had a quick look at milk consumption in the world.
Right.
So this is just by gross consumption. The country that leads the world in gross consumption of milk is, what do you reckon?
Oh, look, I would have to say the United States.
They come third.
Oh.
Yeah.
China? No.
India.
India?
India.
So they don't eat the cow, but they do drink the milk?
Yes. And a lot of their teas are heavy in milk. Like
oh.
A lot of the tea itself, like the chai tea, is predominantly all milk.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Opposed to, you know, mostly water with a bit of added milk. In India, a lot of the chai is all milk. So that's my assumption of where a lot of the milk gets put in.
So but India has consumes a lot of milk.
This is purely milk. This is not just dairy products. This is purely milk. So that's calculated to be 83 million litres is consumed in India. The EU, not really a country, but that's 24 million litres. And America, 21 million litres of milk consumed.
How many litres is Santa consuming
22
again?
Million. So he's pretty much between the EU and America.
So wait, you're saying that in a 36-hour time window, Santa Claus is drinking as much milk as the entire United States does.
In 1 year.
Okay. Yep. So I'm starting to understand his big belly. So I get that. But obviously he's getting calories. Do we know how many calories from that milk?
Yeah, so milk is 87% water.
Right.
And 149 calories per cup of milk.
Right.
240 mils of milk. Now, I haven't done much more with that because I've decided to focus on calcium.
All right.
So the calories I'll throw to you a bit later because you can work out if he's in calorie deficit or in excess.
Yeah.
But I'll jump to – or did you want to do that now with the cookies?
Let's do cookies. Okay. So all we're right. talking about his caloric. So how many calories did you say he's burning? from moving.
We'll just say 250 million.
Okay, 250 million calories. All right. If we look at the cookies now, how many calories did you say in the glass of milk?
Per cup, 149 calories.
Okay, 149 calories. All right. Per cookie, and he's having one, is about 80 calories per cookie. So if we think about this, 80 calories per cookie times 177 million homes, he's ingesting 14,160,000,000 calories in cookies.
Say that again.
He's ingesting 14,160,000,000 calories of chocolate chip cookies, which are the most popular cookies on the planet, right? Now, if you then add the milk to that, you could probably just double that number in a way to be rough, right? So let's just say he's ingesting something like 16 billion calories just from the milk and cookies that he's ingesting. Now, that far exceeds the calories he's burning from running up and down the chimney and through the house and so forth. He's actually maintaining and holding on to a huge amount of calories, which I assume is going to be ultimately turned either stored as glycogen. So he's probably got a very big liver and huge muscle tissue to be able to hold on to that glycogen, because he's running very quickly, which we'll get to in a sec.
And to be honest, he's probably also scaling down the chimney up and down, which requires a bit more calorie burning than just jogging.
Yeah, probably right. But probably still isn't burning the 30 odd billion calories that he's ingesting.
300, oh, okay. Yeah.
So again, from the cookies, 80 calories. From the milk, let's just say another 80 calories. So we double the 14 billion calories he's ingesting, 30 billion calories he's ingesting. And he's burning 250 million, right, from the running. So there's a lot. So he's going to be storing that probably as adipose fat. Hence why he's got the belly like jelly. Makes sense, especially if he's going to be spending the rest of the 364 days of the year sitting on his bum, letting the elves do all the work. So I can understand now, but he needs that energy obviously for the next.
It's a taxing night.
It would be a taxing night. 7 billion chocolate chip cookies are eaten per year in the United States.
How many?
7 billion. So Santa eats 1/6 of the United States' annual chocolate chip cookies in one night. What they eat in a year, he eats 1/6 of that night.
He's matched the milk intake.
Yeah.
But he's only 1/6 of the cookie intake.
Yeah, he needs to step his game up, I think. So Santa Claus is holding on to a fair bit of those calories. And as we know, unused calories is stored as mass.
Yes. And that's presumably going to be taxing on the reindeer. During the 36 hours.
Well, yeah, depending on how heavy he ends up being. And we'll get back to the reindeer in a second. But let's talk about the milk. Go back to the milk for a second. So in addition to the calories, milk we know has a lot of calcium. And as we know in regards to physiology and calcium homeostasis, we need a certain range of calcium. Too low, hypokalemic. Too high, hyperkalemic. Now, yes. I assume if you're consuming as a single human being – the equivalent milk intake of an entire country in a single night that a country would do in a single year.
There could be some problems.
Yeah. So what's going on?
Well, in that one cup of milk, how I spoke about, that's 87% water, 149 calories, 7.6 grams of protein. Again, this is full cream milk. Also what's in there is, like you mentioned, quite a bit of calcium. And the number is 276 milligrams of calcium per cup.
Okay.
So what's happening now with this calcium? Now, the first thing I'll factor in is that when you – usually with hypercalcemia, so this is excessive amount of calcium within your blood, it doesn't usually come about from too much intake. So it's actually very rare to get hypercalcemia from
– because we pee it out really well?
Well, you'd have to consume a lot, firstly, but yeah, you probably have a fairly good excretion mechanism, but also your homeostatic regulation of the calcium probably would be rectifying this issue.
So calcium issues are mainly due to handling problems?
Yeah, usually it comes down to the activity of osteoclasts, so either through their growth stimulation, so overstimulation from maybe a endocrine disorder, or if there's maybe even bone tumors that cause an extra amount of reabsorption of calcium in the bones.
Right.
So when we look at all the calcium in our body, which is the most abundant metal in our body, is calcium, 99% of it is in our bones. So only less, 0.9% is actually in our extracellular fluid. And this is presumably where his calcium will go.
Because
in that 36-hour period, I'm guessing that he won't have time to put that into his bones.
Oh, so you don't think he's big boned?
He could be. But I don't think he'll have that physiological capacity to put all that calcium into his bones within that short period of time.
Gotcha. But maybe after he finishes, goes home and sits down and relaxes, he could start storing. So is he hyperkalemic then?
So let's just factor this in now. So he's taken a lot of milk in, therefore a lot of calcium. Firstly, what I'll mention is the bioavailability of calcium, that means getting it orally, digesting whatever the food is, absorbing it, getting it through your liver and then into your blood, the bioavailability is only 30%.
Okay.
So he's going to lose two-thirds of what he ingests.
Good.
From a calcium standpoint. Now, there are some foods that even decrease the absorption ability even more.
Like?
So certain foods with high in oxalic acid. So these are usually green leafy stuff.
No, I don't think the dude's eaten a salad for a long time.
The only thing I could find was another acid called phytic acid, yep, which apparently is in foods with higher fiber. So maybe if the cookies had
wholemeal. No. Nah.
That could impact it a bit.
It doesn't. It's okay. Chocolate chip, high sugar, highly processed, low fiber cookies.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So with that said, let's just be conservative and say that he's only absorbing 30% of the calcium from his milk.
All right. That's fair.
Okay. A couple of other things just to factor in. Based on the exercise that he's likely to be doing, he's probably losing about 126 milligrams an hour of calcium through sweating.
All right.
Okay. And he's wearing a lot of
big suit.
Big suit, so probably even more. But I try to work out what a person would require for running a marathon from a calcium standpoint.
All right.
Because as you know, calcium is very important for action potential but also muscle contraction.
Very much so.
It's not easy, it wasn't easy to find, but I came across a marathon runner to run a marathon would need around 1300 milligrams for a day if they're running quite a lot of
if they're running 42 kilometers.
Yep.
And how many is Santa getting?
So Santa is running, because a marathon's 42 Ks.
Yes.
So Santa's running 84,000 marathons. In 36 hours.
So he's probably world champ ultra marathon runner.
Yes. So he will be requiring 110 million milligrams of calcium.
Okay.
That's what he requires.
And how many is he getting?
24. Well, he takes in 24 billion milligrams, but factor in he'll only absorb 30% of that,
right,
or at least get into his blood. So about 800 million. So he's about seven times over the limit of his calcium, recommended calcium intake.
Which is actually not that much considering how much milk he's ingesting.
So with that said, as I said earlier, most of the calcium that we have in our body, 99%, is in our bones.
Yeah.
So that's not really easily accessible for us. It takes a bit of time to release that calcium into our blood through the activity of osteoclasts. So only 1% of our calcium is in our extracellular fluid. So that's where this calcium is going to go, this eight times the amount.
I would say that Santa Claus, though, being the superhuman that he is, probably has overactive osteoblasts.
Okay.
And I reckon he's taking a lot of that plasma calcium.
Urinating it out.
Yeah, he's probably a urination machine too. And he's probably has to wear a high, heavy-duty nappy throughout his travels. So I don't think he's got time to stop and wee.
Well, that explains his, like, baggy pants.
Yes. Yeah. Or he could just wee off the edge of the sleigh, I suppose.
Or has, like, a bag just off the side of his leg.
Oh, so maybe he's got a catheter.
Catheter in you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's keep going a little bit more.
Yeah.
So the your blood calcium level should be between 8.5 to 10 milligrams per deciliter. That's per 100 mils. So when you factor in a person that maybe have 6 liters of blood, that's about 500 milligrams of calcium in your blood.
Okay.
So I reckon he's exceeded that.
Yeah, I think so.
Now, the problem with calcium, at least well, both intracellularly and extracellularly. Intracellularly, if you have too much calcium, it's not a very abundant cation in your cells. And the main reason for that, it's stored in your cells, but in compartments like in mitochondria or sarcoplasmic reticulum. But if it's let out as a free ion within your cell basically die. And that's usually the process of apoptosis. It just releases calcium and then that generates calcium-dependent activity.
So what are you saying with Santa?
Well, he has to regulate that pretty well. But also looking at the extracellular, there's going to be certain activities where he will need a bit more, that being action potentials of neurons and muscles. So they're probably going to be requiring additional calcium ions to – I don't think he needs a great deal of clotting, which is another use of calcium. So I think basically it's just action potentials and muscles that are going to be utilizing this calcium. Now, before I get into some of the maybe side effects of what he may experience from the calcium, just something I will add to this. Do you think, judging by his activity and potentially his altitude, he may experience any degree of acidosis? Because that could impact the way that calcium binds to albumin.
Probably.
Okay.
What do you think? I mean, I know that if he's moving as quickly as we're going to tell the listener that he's moving, he's going to have a huge amount of carbon dioxide building up. So I would say that he's at least having some degree of respiratory acidosis.
Okay, so if he's retaining a bit of CO2, that means he'll go into an acidotic state.
Yeah.
That will impact the way that hydrogen will then bind to albumin, and then albumin is a holder on of calcium, and then because it's taken on the buffering effect of hydrogen, it will let go more calcium. So he's probably even more hyperkalemic because of this reason. So what will he experience from being hyperkalemic? Well, the main issue is his excitable cells. So like we said, neurons and muscles. What it kind of does is it plays around with the way that sodium can get into the cell. So surprisingly, it actually dampens excitable cells down. So it makes them less excitable, harder to depolarize. So therefore, he will experience things like slower or absent reflexes. He's going to maybe be more lethargic, but you wouldn't really think he is. He's not really demonstrating that anyway. He may develop constipation. That could also be the low fiber.
I don't think he poos in that 36-hour time period. There's no time, again, unless they're nappy.
And then if it gets really serious, he can start to become confused and hallucinate.
Which I would too, to be honest, after doing this. But I reckon this is my assumption based off first principles. If he's got so much calcium in his system and he's functioning well enough to be able to deliver these presents every year, right, I think his body, his metabolism and his physiology has shifted to use calcium as the positive ion that it is in the action potential, probably to replace the sodium influx. I reckon when he goes to spark an action potential to send a signal to tell a muscle to contract, I reckon calcium is used as the prime cation, the positive ion that does this. Usually it's sodium. I reckon calcium's doing it. I reckon his body is shifted to use calcium
instead
in this process.
Sodium.
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
And then ultimately he's going to have his sarcoplasmic reticuli that holds calcium in the muscle, which then needs to be released to tell muscle to contract. I reckon his sarcoplasmic reticuli are huge. I think he's got these giant stores of calcium. I think Santa Claus's physiology has adapted so well that he takes this calcium. His osteoblasts are overactive, chucking that calcium into his bones. He's got crazy strong bones, this man, which he needs
because
these muscles, just wait till you hear the forces that this man has to withstand. But also I think the calcium's used in that action potential and muscle contraction.
So that's basically calcium. Just a couple of potential therapies that he can consider if he does experience these issues. He'd obviously have to increase his fluid intake because his kidneys are trying to excrete a lot. So he probably should go on to probably an IV solution of normal saline throughout the night. A loop diuretic wouldn't go astray because that can increase the excretion.
Yeah, but it would be peeing again all night.
That's right, but he'll just maybe need that bag in place.
Wow, the price you pay for delicious milk and cookies.
And then calcitonin. If as a another means of excreting the calcium.
I still think his physiology is adapted very well to this because, as we're going to find out right now, we need to talk about how quickly this man moves, right? So we said that when he lands on a house, he's running, he's going down the chimney, delivering the presents, going back up around about 20 meters per house, right? But he then has to go from house to house. And so what we calculated was, considering all the houses he needs to visit around the world, that the, let's just say, the average distance between one house to another is 1 kilometer. So what that means is, in total around the world, because he has to visit 177 million homes, each a kilometer apart, he's traveling 177 million kilometers, and he needs to do this within 36 hours, which means Santa Claus and the sleigh is traveling at 4.9 million kilometers per hour. That's quick.
That's moving quick.
Right? Now, the highest velocity reached by a human in Earth's atmosphere, because Santa Claus is still going through Earth's atmosphere, I assume he's not going out into space to do this.
No, it would make sense.
Right? So in Earth's atmosphere was a US Air Force jet called an X-15, and it traveled 7,273 kilometers an hour. So Santa Claus is traveling 674 times faster than that. Crazy. Now,
that's just from the reindeer.
And that's from the reindeer, right? The Mach speed that is traveling. So if you calculate, so Mach speed is simply how many times faster than the speed of sound are you traveling, right? So you take.
So one, is it Mach or Mac?
I say Mach.
Okay.
Mach speed. Look, we are biologists.
Okay. So is one Mach just the speed of sound? So it's a bit faster than 1,000 k's an hour?
Basically, yeah. 1,234 kilometers an hour is basically the speed of sound. So if you take the speed of an object, like the sleigh, and divide it by the speed of sound, you get the Mach.
Okay.
Or Mach. Santa Claus is traveling at 3,970 Mach. That's the Mach speed, right? So Mach is all about the compressibility of the gas in front of it. Because if you think about it, when you travel through an atmosphere, there's gases in the atmosphere. Mainly oxygen and nitrogen, right? So when you travel really fast, that gas becomes a medium that you need to travel through, like swimming through water. It becomes really difficult because the air molecules can't get out of the road fast enough. So you, as you travel faster and faster, need to push through it and split those molecules out the road. Now, if you're, let's just say, a rocket that, you know, is re-entering Earth's atmosphere, so a rocket that we have as human beings, that's traveling at Mach 25.
Does it have to be a particular speed to get back into the atmosphere? Like, do you have to go at a certain speed? Like, you can't just...
No, not to get back in.
Really?
But
I thought it's the other way around. I thought you can just float out, but no, to get opposite. Back in.
Opposite.
Really?
Because you've got to overcome gravity pulling you back into Earth.
Now, like, say, like a hot air balloon, right?
Yeah.
You can just keep floating up and up and up until you're into space, right?
Yeah, but that's because you're lighter than air.
Yeah. But what I mean is, you can't, once you're outside the atmosphere, you can't just float back in, right? You're outside the...
No, you can definitely float back in. So, for example...
Okay.
Yeah, so the International Space Station has to actively maintain its orbit. It's not just orbiting.
But it is, yeah. But it is traveling at speed, but it just seems to be relative to the Earth's rotation, right?
Yes, so it is traveling basically... The International Space Station is constantly falling to Earth, yeah, but is traveling so fast that it's falling, and as it falls down, it's falling away from the curvature of the Earth. Mm. So it is constantly falling to Earth, yeah, and it does drop, so you need to boost it back out a little bit, right? Yeah. So that there's still gravity there. You've got to travel a fair way to get out of it. I mean, think about it. We still experience the moon's gravity because we have tides, right?
Point.
So we're definitely experiencing Earth's gravity even when we're on the moon.
Okay.
Right? And we're still experiencing, so 1/3 of the tidal forces is actually from the sun. Right? So there's still gravity. Yeah. So you're still going against the gravity. But when you're falling back in, you're falling not just at the speed of gravity, which is 9.1-ish meters per second squared, but that starts to accumulate and go faster and faster and faster. So anyway, if you're traveling at Mach 25, which is the speed of a shuttle re-entering our atmosphere, it has to push those gas molecules out the road. So the nose or the cone of that shuttle gets crazy hot and really red, right? And it's pushing the molecules out. It actually is going so fast through the molecules, it can't push them out the road.
Rudolph.
It splits those molecules and turns the molecules of the gas in the atmosphere into ionized plasma, which makes the nose of the shuttle red, red hot. Now, what's the nose? What's the equivalent nose of Santa Claus's sleigh?
The front reindeer? Is the front reindeer Rudolph?
Yeah, of course it is. Okay. The red-nosed reindeer. His nose is red, Matt, simply because he's pushing gas molecules out the road. They are becoming ionized plasma, and he has a super burning hot nose close to the surface of the sun. That's right. Now, think about this, right? I said Santa Claus is traveling at a Mach speed of 3,970. The space shuttle is going Mach 25. Now, the thing is this. If you ask the question, well, what sort of Mach can a human being experience before they have issues? It's actually, the speed is got nothing to do with human physiology. Human beings, theoretically, can travel at any speed.
Light speed.
As long as it's constant.
I've seen movies like that.
Yes. So those movies are obviously correct. The problem is when you accelerate and decelerate. And so this is when we look at G-force. Right. So G-force is all about the acceleration and deceleration. So basically G-force is the force experienced by an object with reference to the acceleration due to gravity. So for example, 1G is the amount of force that gravity is placing on us right now, which is 9.8 meters per second squared. So if I were to hold an apple and let go of it, that's 1G's worth of force. The apple is experiencing 1G. Now, if you multiply that by 2, that's 2G. Multiply it by 3, 3G. Now, if you're experiencing a positive G-force, what that means is the blood's going to rush to your feet, right? If you're experiencing a negative G-force, blood is going to rush to your brain and eyes. Now, Santa is doing a lot
of... If you're moving in that direction, up and down, right?
Not necessarily, but mostly yes.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Santa does a lot of acceleration and braking. So think about this. Santa Claus is traveling at 4.9 million kilometers an hour, but he's going from house to house at that speed and then having to stop. So he's traveling at 4.9 million kilometers an hour only for 1 kilometer and then has to dead stop to 0 kilometers an hour, then has to accelerate back to 4.9 million kilometers an hour for 1 kilometer
and then suburb.
Yeah, and then brake again. So... And he needs to do this within 1/1000th of a second.
It's a lot of G-forces.
To get to all those houses. So he experiences a negative G-force and a positive G-force, depending on whether you're accelerating or braking, of 138 million G. Right. Now, let's think about this. If you just take a look at 3G, somebody's blood pressure is going to double. Somebody's respiratory rate is going to change. Heart rate is going to go up.
So this is an aeroplane can fly at this speed?
That's right. So for example, if you are accelerating, right, to 3G.
From 0 to 3G.
Yeah. Blood's going to rush to your feet.
Okay.
Moves away from your brain.
Yep.
Once blood's moved away from your brain, now whether it be due to this gravity change, whether it be due to some sort of vasovagal effect, or whether it be due to me choking you out, you've got around about 4 to 6 seconds of useful consciousness.
So that is that where the pilots have to do certain maneuvers to stop that happening?
Yes. So if you think about it, all the blood's going to – you've got venous pooling. So the blood pools in your venous system and it pulls down at your feet. And so they tense, they contract all the muscles in their body and they try and do very short, shallow, sharp breathing to maintain oxygen intake and outtake because there's a lot of compressive forces placed on the body as well. So the way you should think about it is acceleration, G-force, positive G-force, it's mimicking hypovolemic circulation, almost like if you're hemorrhaging. So what happens when you hemorrhage, Matt? What happens when you have hypovolemia physiologically? Heart rate goes up.
Well, that's how you compensate. Yeah.
That's how you compensate. Your sympathetic nervous system gets activated. Same thing happens. So Santa Claus is experiencing this to a significant degree. He's actually experiencing 138 million G-force when he accelerates and a negative 138 million G-force when he brakes. So to stop him from passing out every time he does this, he needs a compression suit, which is the red suit that he wears, yeah, Matt. Yeah. Now, he's got the black boots, crazy strong compression to stop that venous pooling down at the legs, but he's also got the hat, and that's going to be a huge compressive force. Now, he's so strong due to that bone density, right, true, that he's got from the calcium and the muscular strength that he has from having to carry all of these presents, and I'll tell you how many presents he's carrying in a second, that he can contract his muscles so strongly, his bones resist the compressive forces, and this suit, if you were to put Santa's suit on and you were to experience the compressive forces, you'd be crushed into like a little tin can, right? It's more compressive force than you'd experience at the bottom of the Marianas Trench.
Compressive man.
A compressive man?
No. Oh.
So he's a... He is a tough SOB, Santa Claus.
How does the hat, his little black...
he doesn't wear a black hat. He wears a red hat with white fur.
Yeah, that's right. Black shoes. Black boots.
That's right.
So the red hat,
yeah.
How does that overcome his skull?
Look, his bone density is very strong. And I don't know how that's compressing the vascular supply within the skull. But I think Santa Claus, he's got such strong neck muscles, I think. Because if you're accelerating to 4.9 million kilometers an hour from zero to that within a kilometer, well, within 1/1000th of a second, to be honest.
Do you think also his suit's possibly got some titanium or lead lining or something to overcome the...
Well, I heard that Santa Claus actually contacted NASA and his suit's made out of the same material that the tiles of the NASA shuttles are made.
Right.
Yeah. So... This man is wearing heat resistance and compression resistance.
Copping the crux of the compressive forces.
All on the nose, but if you have a look, his nose is shaped so perfectly that it breaks that the gases that is traveling through so that all the other reindeer and Santa Claus don't have to experience it.
So he doesn't really need that.
No. Santa's not really experiencing those forces. The temperature that Rudolph is. But he still, you know, likes to protect himself and his suit's made out of the same material as the NASA space shuttle. So, you know, it's absolutely amazing the type of stuff that Santa Claus is going through.
Should we quickly talk about altitude then?
Let's talk about altitude and then I want to talk about the amount of presents he's carrying. And then we can talk about him going through the chimney.
That's called the payload.
Yes, yeah. Yes. All right, so... How high up do you think he's going to travel from house to house?
Well, first of all, I came across the most efficient flight path that he's recommended to take.
Right.
And this is actually by Lufthansa, German flight company.
Yeah, yeah.
They're an airline,
so you don't have to call them a flight company.
I don't know how this actually works in terms of time zones, because this actually wouldn't work. It's maybe he's reversing this path, but... They've basically suggested that he goes from North Pole to Europe, then to the Middle East, up into Russia, then down to Asia, across to Africa, then jumping across to the Americas. So he will have to traverse the Atlantic. So across to North America, South America, and then up to Hawaii, New Guinea, then finish in Australia, New Zealand. But
Which is interesting because we experience Christmas before everywhere else on the planet.
He has to reverse this.
Yeah, Lufthansa did a bad job. Plus, he doesn't. I mean, my assumption is not everybody celebrates Christmas. I think that's a fair assumption.
Yep.
And so he's probably not delivering every household in all these countries.
Have to go to all these continents, though.
He would.
It'd be safe to assume that every continent will have children to deliver to.
So what about the altitude?
Well, let's have a look at the most efficient altitude to fly.
Right. For a commercial flight?
Yes.
Yep.
So the higher you go, the less drag.
Because there's less molecules.
Correct. So there's technically, the higher you go, the more efficient you will be able to travel.
The easier it is on Rudolph's nose.
However, at least with aeroplanes, they require a combustion engine, which is the essentially burning fuel, which does require oxygen. And so the problem there is as you go higher, it's going to become less efficient in terms of that particular, chemical reaction.
But Santa's not using a chemical reaction.
I'm getting there. Okay. I'm getting there. So usually when it comes to the...
Unless he works off reindeer farts. Is that how they build their speed?
When it comes to a commercial airline, it's somewhere between 35,000 to 42,000 feet. They use feet. So that's the most efficient... That's the sweet spot to travel. Taking into consideration the drag, less weather events to have to tackle, but also not few enough oxygen that you won't be able to... burn your fuel.
Okay.
But the highest that an aeroplane has flown is 123,000 feet. And that was a MiG jet, a Russian MiG jet. Concorde.
Is that a commercial jet?
No, that's the highest jet ever.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Concorde would typically cruise at 50 to 60,000 feet.
Yeah, but that don't exist anymore.
That's right. Now, This is taken into consideration that the cabin of the plane is pressurized. The highest that you can most unpressurized cabins, they generally don't go beyond 10,000 feet.
Unpressurized. Right.
So if it's an open...
fuselage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They can't go much higher than 10,000. They can probably go into the 12s. But
just because the oxygen diminishes so much. Yeah. And obviously it gets cold.
So you need to take that into consideration. Yeah, and even once you go to 40,000, you're at negative 57 degrees Celsius.
Right, a bit cold.
It's cold.
But Santa Claus would be used to that temperature.
But whether that speed that, you know, Rudolph's copying, whether that will heat them up.
Maybe. Plus he's got the suit.
Yeah. So the consideration I guess I'm trying to make here is if his sleigh is open... open cabin.
I assume so, yeah.
He's not going to be able to pressurize it.
Yeah.
So he can only go at a certain height. So let's...
So 10,000 feet.
Arguably.
Yeah.
So now let's have a quick look at pressure changes in terms of all the gases that are acting in the atmosphere at different levels of altitude.
Yep.
So we know at sea level. What's the pressure, the atmospheric pressure?
Well, what, 560 millimeters of mercury?
760.
Oh, 760, yeah.
So what does this basically mean in terms of this number?
Well, if I were to stand next to the ocean and I would put a tube above me, a 1 meter in diameter tube that goes all the way up out into the atmosphere, all the gas molecules above me in that tube would weigh or exert a pressure down onto me of 760 millimeters of mercury.
Okay.
And I always say to my students, they always say, how come we don't feel it? It's just, because you're born into it.
Yeah.
Of course you don't feel it. So anyway, that's sea level. But anytime you go up, there's less molecules above your face putting pressure on you, right?
And what are the main gases?
Nitrogen predominantly.
And so that's 70-something percent?
Yeah. Then oxygen.
Oxygen's 21%.
Then carbon dioxide.
Yeah.
And then trace gases.
Okay. So let's just focus on oxygen now. So 21% of the atmosphere is oxygen. So as you go up in altitude, this percentage doesn't change, but what does change is the pressure.
Right.
Happy with that? So if you go up to 10,000 feet, which is kind of the ceiling for an unpressurized cabin, that is 523 millimeters of mercury of just pressure. So when you
20% of that is only going to be around about 1,000 millimeters of mercury worth of oxygen pressure.
Yeah, so, or actually...
Oh, sorry, 500, 100 millimeters of mercury worth of oxygen pressure-ish, right?
Yeah. So let's go back and just say at 760, which is sea level.
Yeah.
The oxygen in the air is 159 millimeters of mercury.
Yeah.
Happy with that?
Yep.
You go up to 10,000, now it's dropped to 110.
Right.
Now, normally in your alveoli, you would have 104 millimeters of mercury. So down at your alveoli level, so once you've gone through your mouth all down the whole tree of your bronchioles and et cetera, once you're right down to the alveoli where gas exchange occurs, it's 104 millimeters of mercury.
And it needs to be that so the oxygen can jump from your lungs into your blood.
Yes, that's right.
Right. So if you go any lower than that in the atmosphere, it means that there's not enough pressure in your lungs to throw the oxygen into your bloodstream.
Correct.
And that's why 10,000 feet is the limit, because that's the same pressure as your lungs.
So when you go to 10,000 feet, the partial pressure, we should have brought this back in a bit earlier, but when you do the percentage, 21% in the atmosphere, it causes the partial pressure. So the partial pressure now at 10,000 feet drops to 110. Now when you go across to your alveoli, this is now going to be about 67 partial pressure millimeters of oxygen. So this is probably now getting to the point where you're not getting overly efficient with gas exchange crossing into your blood.
Yeah.
Make sense?
Yeah, because you, like I said, in the lungs, it needs to be about 100 millimeters of mercury worth of oxygen pressure to jump from your lungs into your blood. If it goes below that, the pressure's not high enough. And think about the pressure as the pushing force. So there's not enough pushing force to push the oxygen into your blood once you go above 10,000 feet. So SANA has to be at around 10,000 feet, right?
Yep. Now, just to give you one more point of reference, let's go to the highest mountain on the planet, so Mount Everest. This is 29,000 feet. Okay, so the barometric pressure there is 253, okay?
Right, low. Now,
it's much lower. Now, a couple of factors just to bring in here is water vapor pressure is 47. It's fairly steady through the pressure ranges. So there, that means water is taking up space at 47 millimeters of mercury in your lung alveoli. Mm-hmm. Now, you're also going to be producing carbon dioxide because you're doing activity. So you need to be expelling that out of your blood into your alveoli. So that's taking up space. So you're only really left with 47 millimeters of pressure, partial pressure of oxygen at Mount Everest. That's with just breathing in.
But there's no children up on top of Mount Everest that Santa needs to deliver to.
No, but this is what he may have to consider altitude
changes.
Changes.
So what do you think he's doing?
Well, but then, as you know, with people who climb Mount Everest, they're not generally just breathing in atmospheric air. They're taking oxygen bottles up with them.
So, okay. Santa, you reckon, has got a couple of tanks?
Well, if you look at the oxygen for Mount Everest, so if you go, let's go to Mount Everest, what did we say the height was? So we'll call it 30,000. So if you're breathing oxygen, pure oxygen, you can bring it up fairly to a livable physiological amount at Mount Everest if you're breathing in pure oxygen, because that takes out all the other gases. It gets rid of nitrogen and so forth. So now you're just purely oxygen, and that pressure, even though it's at 253 millimeters of mercury, if it's 100% or close enough to it, you can get that partial pressure of oxygen at your alveoli, which is close to at sea level.
Now, the thing I'm worried about most of all with Santa doing this is that he's actually ascending to these altitudes very quickly.
Yeah.
Now, when people usually climb a mountain, they have to do it quite slowly because they can get something called acute altitude sickness. So is Santa Claus susceptible to getting, firstly, what is acute altitude sickness? What happens when you get it? And do you think Santa Claus is susceptible to getting this?
Depends what he was doing during the year. So,
he could be doing training.
So if you acclimatize, the efficiency of your body, if you've spent time acclimatizing, is significant. So some of the things that body will go through, if you do spend the time to acclimatize, your pulmonary ventilation is much more improved. So that just the way that you ventilate your lung is much better. You increase a huge amount of red blood cells. So these carry the oxygen. So you're more efficient at carrying oxygen in your blood. Your diffusion capacity, so this is getting oxygen across your alveoli membrane, is heightened. The vasculature, not only in your lung but in your body, has also improved. And then also your cellular ability to work at kind of hypoxic levels is much better. So they,
so if he does altitude training or hypobaric training, this could, he could be adapted to this, which means he might do a lot better and not get this altitude sickness. Because in altitude sickness, you can get confusion and dizziness. The lack of oxygen leads to a whole bunch of vascular changes, oxidative stress changes, leads to fluid being shifted in and out of the cells of your tissues, including your brain. Your brain can swell and you can get a whole bunch of really nasty effects.
Yes, that's right. But so I calculated just quickly, the ceiling for him, so he can't really exceed this. If he has no oxygen on board, he can't really go beyond 20,000 feet to travel, even though he's up and down.
Yeah.
He can't really go an hour at that, at 23,000 feet without any oxygen, he's going to start to come into this altitude sickness. Or the maximum he can go with oxygen is 47,000 feet.
Right. The other thing with altitude sickness is it doesn't usually kick in for about 2 days. Well, so he might not get it until he's back home, feet up.
Well, I'm going to disagree with that.
Okay.
And this comes from anecdotal evidence from me.
Yes.
Well, actually not me personally, but the person I traveled with. So I was in South America backpacking and we were in the top of Chile at sea level and we went up to Bolivia, La Paz, which I think is about 4,000 meters. Now, we went from sea level to 4,000 meters in half a day.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, within a few hours, I noticed the difference, but my friend got really, really sick.
So sick, but he didn't have cerebral edema.
No, but he was like...
Or pulmonary edema, which are the big ones.
Very fatigued, nauseous, to the point where we were crossing the border from Chile to Bolivia, which was a big mountain pass, and he had issues with his passport and visas, and they weren't going to let him in, and he was like, just leave me here.
Wow.
Couldn't be stuffed.
So I think that's...
So he got sick quite pretty quickly.
While that is altitude sickness, that is different to the cerebral edema and pulmonary edema induced, which does usually happen a couple of days afterwards.
Yep.
And that is due to a consistently low oxygen and the vascular oxidative changes.
Two main things with acute altitude sickness that Santa may experience, possibly not in the 36 hours, possibly at the end of that 36-hour period, or maybe when he gets back to the North Pole.
Yeah.
Cerebral edema, as you said, that seems to be due to the hypoxia, which then causes vasodilation in the brain tissue,
yeah,
which then causes fluid to come out into the brain, causing the edema. The other big effect, which is part of the reason why he has that voice that you spoke about at the start.
Yeah, gruff voice. Yeah.
Is he may be experiencing pulmonary edema. Mm. Now, the reason for that, especially if he's not acclimatized, is as the lung tissue is being poorly ventilated because of the altitude that we spoke about, usually the way that the lung tries to compensate for poorly ventilated areas is to vasoconstrict, right?
Mm.
And so you don't want to bring blood to a part of the lung that's poorly ventilated with oxygen, right? So you vasoconstrict the pulmonary vessels and you take it to other parts of the lung that maybe has better ventilation. And so if you keep constricting areas of the lung, it's going to bump up pulmonary pressure. So he starts to develop pulmonary hypertension. Yeah.
So the parts of the lung that are healthy that are receiving the blood is receiving high-pressured blood. And it's like squirting it through these vessels and just increasing the fluid buildup in lung tissue. So poor Sam. But I think you're right. I think in the 364 days off, even though he's at the North Pole, at sea level, which is where the North Pole is, I think he's doing hypobaric altitude or
blood
training.
Blood doping.
Well, he could be doing some blood doping. I mean...
EPO?
I think, yeah. Well, I heard Santa is definitely a cyclist. So, all right. Now, can we move on to...
That's altitude done. So my guess is he's not really going much beyond 12,000 feet on his highest cruising speed.
12,000 feet.
12,000 feet.
Okay. So he's traveling at 4.9 kilometers
an hour. He just doesn't have the ability to carry big oxygen bottles.
Probably not. But he's probably got a super cool mask that he's got. I wouldn't be surprised.
Built into his
suit.
No, into his beard.
Oh, yeah. Maybe the beard turns into a mask. Anyway, let's talk about the presents he's carrying, right? So his sleigh obviously carries enough presents for all the children that are getting presents, whether it be coal or actual gifts. And so...
Carried in what, though?
Well, let's think about this. If he delivers one present per child. We know he delivers more.
Assuming that they're not all naughty.
Correct. Even if they are naughty, it's going to be filled with coal.
So 200 grams of coal.
So just wait. So he's delivering one present per kid. Each present, let's just say, is 200 grams. That means he's delivering 124,000 ton or 124 million kilograms of presents to children around the world. Now, 124,000 ton. A standard dump truck carries 15 tons. So Santa's sleigh is likely not just one sleigh, but multiple sleighs. So he's probably, now if each sleigh is the size of a dump truck, his reindeer are probably pulling 8,266 sleighs.
Right.
Filled with presents, which may be toys or coal. No judgment.
Is he just stopping at depots along the way?
I think he's just got it all filled up.
Okay.
Filled from the beginning, man. He takes it from the North Pole. It's all there.
Does he kind of drop off sleighs along the way?
I don't think so. He has to take it back because he's got to refill it for the next year. God, you're an idiot. So
That's a lot of drag.
Well, think about this. Well, considering there's a lot of drag, the reindeer need to have a lot of pulling force. The horsepower or the reindeer power.
Reindeer power.
Right? Yeah. So let's think about this. So he's carrying 124,000 tons of presents. He needs to visit a little over 1,000 homes per second, right? And is traveling at 4.9 million kilometers an hour. So we can calculate the horsepower here. He's traveling, well, his reindeer are generating 2 billion trillion horsepower. Reindeer power. 2 billion trillion. Now, a space rocket has 34 million horsepower. Santa's sleighs, 2 billion trillion horsepower. So these reindeer are amazing. Better than your goats, Matt.
Yeah. And
your goats pull 124,000 ton? Of anything?
That'd do anything, my goats.
Ridiculous, those goats.
So, and these reindeer, it's rare that I've at least... You know, some people leave out carrots for them, right?
Yes, yes.
Anything else? Hay?
No.
Okay.
Who leaves
that? I don't know. Maybe in some countries.
Carrots.
In some countries, like I came across that they don't leave cookies, they leave rice pudding and some other things.
Poor Santa. Yeah. Who wants rice pudding? Maybe.
Well, that's got milk in it.
Germans could leave a sausage.
Yeah.
So he might get a bit of protein.
Guessing some countries will leave some stuff out for the reindeers. But
hope so.
They're pretty impressive.
They're burning more energy than Santa.
That's right.
Right? Haven't calculated that, but I'm sure it's a lot. Matt, the last thing I want to talk about here is when he goes through all these chimneys, there's a lot of soot in chimneys.
Well, let's go back to what is he carrying his presents in?
A sack.
Yeah. And what color is it?
Red.
Yeah. So I've deduced the reason for this.
Oh.
It's squamous cell carcinoma of the scrotum.
Oh, so he's actually not carrying a sack of presents. He's just carrying a cancerous scrotum.
That's right. And that's where it's derived from. So
wow.
Let me explain my point here.
Please do.
So as you said, he's traveling up and down a chimney,
yeah,
which is a lot of chimneys. I can't remember the number on top of my head.
Well, we had 177 million homes and... Let's just say 50% have chimneys.
No, we got to go with them all.
So, really?
Yep.
I don't have a chimney.
Okay.
Do you?
No.
Okay. So there we go.
Okay. But how's he getting into the house then?
I give him leave a key under the mat.
Okay, fair enough. All right. So let's just say
breaks a window.
The houses that do have a chimney, he's still going through a lot of chimneys.
Yeah.
Okay. So the issue here is an issue that was brought to the attention of the world in the 1700s. Okay, so this is called chimney sweeps carcinoma.
Also known as sootwort.
Also known as, well, it was confused with the French pox. Apparently, so which I think is just syphilis.
Right.
As you said, it's affecting the scrotum.
Yeah.
And in those days, anything that was impacting the genitals or the junk... was assumed to be
is what they said.
A venereal disease, right?
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, and we still do this today, if we have some kind of outbreak...
On the junk, as you say.
Or no, just generally. Countries blame other countries for it. So, you know, the Brits blame the French called it the French pox.
Right.
You know, the French would call it the Spanish pox.
Right.
You know, so forth. the Polish would call it the Russian pox.
Yeah.
And so, you know, all the
I'd call it the Matt pox.
So this particular carcinoma was thought at the time to be a venereal condition.
Yeah.
And in most cases, they treated it with
mercury
paste,
of course,
or arsenic paste.
Yeah, that's going to be great for your scrotum.
So that wouldn't overly help.
No.
So it wasn't actually. No, I'll bring in the reason for why we need to clean the chimney out to begin with. So I'm doing a slight
digression
side point,
here.
Digression here to why we need chimney sweeps to begin with.
Right. I think it's obvious, isn't it?
Well.
Chimneys filled with soot, and soot needs to be taken away, otherwise chimneys
clog. But it was especially bad in England.
Right.
London. Now, the reason for this that I came across, London had a great fire in 1665.
How great was it?
Significantly.
It was awesome.
A lot of the city burnt down. So they brought in the Housing Tax Act at the end of the 17th century.
Did that say stop making your house out of hay?
No. What it said is... you have to pay tax on how many chimneys you have, okay?
So the more chimneys, more tax.
Correct.
That's done. Why is that?
Because I guess
increased likelihood of fires.
Yeah.
But if you had less chimneys, wouldn't that also be?
Look, I didn't go into the details of this. Okay. I just came across that housing tax.
Digressing on chimney sweeps.
So what people did to get around this, because most rooms still had a fireplace, mm-hmm. is they built these crazy little chutes or flutes. Is it flutes?
Yeah.
Anyway, into the main one.
Right.
And so a house would have all these small little chimneys into one big chimney that would come out of the top of the house.
Gotcha.
And so these small little narrow ones would be the ones that would be problematic to
clogged get up
with soot. So who do you bring in at that time of the
Ghostbusters.
You bring in kids.
Of course you do.
And so...
they fit in those chimneys.
Yeah, that's right. So young... particularly young boys.
Oh, young kids. Yep. Okay. As
between,
opposed to
between the age
the 43-year-old children.
Between the age of 4 to 7.
Yeah.
They would slide down the chimneys and do the cleaning.
Right.
So these, and a lot of them were from orphanages and so forth, so it's pretty bad. But I guess at the time there was not a great deal of options. So they were going down the chimney and they were cleaning it out, mostly naked.
Really?
Wearing very limited stuff because it's so hot. You're not going right. to...
Well, the fire's not on while they're
that's
there.
That's true, but it's still hot. So they're cleaning it out almost naked. And some other things is that you need to factor in is they'd only rarely bath. So they would only bath once a year.
Once a year?
Yeah, very rare.
Wow. So more than you.
And the other thing is they would probably sleep in... that would be the only set of kind of... clothing, so they'd probably sleep.
Right, so they're covered in soot, they don't clean, but this is a cancer of the scrotum.
Yeah.
Why the scrotum?
Well, there was some hypotheses that the thought was that as the child would sweat, or the sweat would run down the body and then kind of accumulate.
In the rugae of the scrotum. The balls, scrotum, yes. Not testes.
It kind of just accumulate in that
balls
region.
Balls is not an appropriate term.
So that's probably not entirely true, but some of the rugae
that makes sense though.
The rugae is probably a good hypothesis that the soot gets accumulated in there, particularly if they're not bathing very frequently. There's a lot of sebaceous glands, and the absorption capacity is quite high.
Really?
In that region, so that is part of the reason why it's hypothesized that the scrotum was impacted more so. But the cancerous agent, so the carcinogenic agent, was a benzopyrene. And that seemed to, well, this is demonstrated more recently, to affect the guanine. What's the G in?
Yeah, guanine.
Guanine. Particularly in the genes of the P53
really?
on chromosome 17. So they've shown that, I think this was in the 19th century, that if you were to get agents that were tar-like, and this would be a benzopyrene-like material, and they did this in rabbits, rubbed it on their ears, that their squamous cell carcinoma of the ear was enhanced.
All right. Let's bring this back to Santa Claus.
So Santa Claus is doing a lot of traversing
chimneys. Probably sweating a lot in that big red suit.
Although he is wearing a suit.
So do you think that Santa, I'm sure he's got some protective... I wouldn't be surprised. He's done this for years.
So I think he's significantly aware of
the risks
of this whole soot cancer, or the soot wart that it was called. And I think he's probably wearing some sort of cup around his genitalia to stop the soot from accumulating in that area.
But it's remarkable that he keeps his suit so red.
And clean. Yeah, I think it's soot-proof.
Okay.
Definitely soot-proof. Plus the speed that is travelling through the air, that soot just goes, whoosh, washes straight off. Matt?
So that's the chimney sweep carcinoma. That was its history. It wasn't really until the 1840s that they banned children to do this kind of work. But it was a huge... It was actually the first occupational cancer known. It was discovered by Percival Pott in 1775. Who was a surgeon, and they did demonstrate if you got to it early and were able to remove the tumour, that the survival was quite good. But
all right,
many didn't get to that point.
Okay, well, that's depressing. So Santa Claus is a freak of a human being, if we can call him a human being. So
supra-physiological.
Look, he has to visit 1,365 houses per second. He's travelling with his reindeer at 4.9 million kilometres an hour at a Mach speed of 3,970, which is insane. He's experiencing G-forces in the positive and negative of 138 million, which is crazy. He's travelling at altitudes of above 10,000 feet. He is experiencing significant lacks of oxygen and temperature changes. He's ingesting huge amounts, around about a bit over 30 billion calories, and expending around about 250 million calories.
Calcium.
So holding on to that. He's hyperkalemic, but we believe that physiologically he's using that calcium in ways that's benefiting him on this Christmas Eve.
He's not obese, he's just big boned.
His big bone, that's right. Exactly right. He's carrying 124,000 ton of presents and probably carrying maybe around about 8,266 dump truck-sized sleighs to carry this. His reindeer are amazing. Rudolph's nose...
They're probably better, really.
It's all on them, I think. They're breaking air speeds, well, at least Rudolph is, at 4.9 kilometers an hour. Which is far greater than a shuttle re-entering orbit, breaking that air in front of him, hence his red nose, and generating 2 billion trillion horsepower in doing so. And luckily for us, Santa Claus has protected himself.
Prophylactically.
So he does not get...
Scrotal cancer.
Scrotal cancer. Mm-hmm. He's wearing a suit that's resisting the G-forces that he's experiencing, so a compressive suit, and that compression is obviously also helping him for any edemic or edema-based issues. So, look, I have to... Take my Christmas hat off to Santa and...
And the reindeer, really.
And to the reindeer and say, look, all...
They're the forgotten heroes.
That's right. Also, you can just deliver presents to our kids.
Or Cole.
Well, your kids. So, this is the science of Santa. I hope you enjoyed it. It's for a bit of fun. You don't need to correct us if we got anything wrong because I'm sure... we didn't get anything wrong. So enjoy that. If you want to contact us and wish us a Merry Christmas, please do so. Merry Christmas to you. Happy holidays. You can send us an email, gubiosciences@gmail.com. You can contact us on social media, predominantly me, Dr. Mike Todorovic, DrMiketodorovic. And you can subscribe to our YouTube channel, Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike, and also leave a 5-star review for us, please. I'm so desperate for a 5-star review saying how much we've helped you. And if you send us an email from here on forward, I will read that email out unless on the next podcast episode, unless you tell me not to do so. But please, send an email. You can ask questions. You can just state comments, whatever it may be.
Suggested topics.
But write something in. We'll read it out on the at the end of each podcast. And thank you for your support. We love you all and have a wonderful, wonderful holiday.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right.
because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.